My castaway this week is one of Britain's most popular comedians. He left school at 16 with a passable impersonation of Elvis Presley, after which a win on a television talent show launched him on a career as a stand-up comic. It wasn't until he was in his early 20s that he found his rightful home among the talented new breed of alternative comedians. One of the moving spirits behind Comic Relief, his non-sexist, non-racist brand of humour, is now enjoyed by millions. He's the creator of such national figures as Theophilus P. Wildy Beastie and Delbert Wilkins. He is, of course, Lenny Henry. Lenny, being discovered on New Faces has presumably turned out to be something of a cross you have to bear. It gets mentioned every time you pop up.
It gets mentioned, but I don't actually mind, because it was the break of a lifetime. I was working in a factory. I'd done an audition, but I'd given up hope of ever hearing from the TV company. And then suddenly they contacted me. And suddenly I was on television. I had no experience. This guy was just saying, just treat the camera like a box of groceries. And there I was on television in front of millions saying hello to my mum. It was a wonderful experience. So I'll always be grateful to programmes like New Faces and Opportunity Knock.
Mind you didn't actually win in the end, did you? We always say you've won New Faces, but you lost to a certain lady called Marty Kane.
I'm glad, actually, because Marty had to go to Las Vegas and she sent me this postcard that said, basically, ah! You know, everything's plastic, I want to come home. And I'm glad, because I think being like 16, 17 in Las Vegas with all these showgirls and in the middle of a lounge with people walking by saying, Martha, can I play the machines? I don't think I would have liked that very much. Yeah. I want to go home.
I want to hear all the gory details of the career in a minute, but first of all, I gather you're an ideal desert island disco because you've had a lifelong love affair, and you are 30 after all, with music.
Yes, and this is through various things. I used to hang out with DJs when I was from 13 onwards, really. I always stood by the decks and watched them playing the records and sort of go, what's that? And so DJ saying, get lost, kid, will you? You're getting all thumbprints over me records. And I used to collect records, and I used to go to Graduate Records in Dudley and look for all the Northern Soul records, you know, that sounded like they'd been recorded in a garage somewhere in San Francisco. And I've always collected records ever since I was, like, from early ages. First record I ever bought was Skin Tight. The last record I bought was De La Soul. And I'll always collect records, and I'm a fan, you know.
We shall not reveal how many times you've changed your mind about your 8 records. We shall ask you instead for the first of them. What is it?
The first one is by the mighty midget from Minneapolis, the purple god himself, Prince, and it's Kiss. They'd rescue me pretty quickly off this desert island anyway, because my arms would be waggling around. I'd be dancing around all the time. So, what's that on that island over there? Some guy dancing on his own. Quick, send out a boat.
That was Prince singing Kiss. Now, Lenny, you were supposed to be an engineer in a Midlands car factory.
Oh, I didn't like it. It wasn't a car factory. It made welding machines. It was called British Federal Welders. It was a good experience, you know, and we had to do sort of odd jobs around the factory before they sent us to college.
Is that what your father did then? Is that
it worked at, he worked at Beans Industries in Cosley. And my mum worked in, because they all worked in factories, you know, and they used to say to us, you know, if you don't study and get your exams, you know, you'll end up in a factory. And is that what you want?
What did your mother do?
She did various things when she came. She used to work as a cook in a hospital. And she worked in various factories, Dudley Drop Forgings, and she did all sorts of stuff, you know.
You say when she came, this is when she came from Jamaica?
Yes, in the mid-50s.
And you were born shortly after that?
I was born in 58.
And how many of you were there, children?
There's 7, and they came. My mum worked for a while, then my dad came over, and he brought my sister. and then they both worked, and then they sent for everybody else. So it was a kind of a, it was a kind of a sort of eventual package deal, you know.
And you, I find this very difficult to believe, but I've been reading about you, and I discovered that you were a dreamy kind of chap who used to stare out of the window a lot.
I do tend to zone out sometimes, you know, I mean, especially at school. I think I was a late developer, really, as far as academia was concerned, because I just wasn't interested. There was nothing to inspire me at school.
And you were no good at sport.
I was useless at sports. I was the one sort of wobbling behind in the sort of cross-country, you know, trying to hide in the bushes with the... Because I never used to smoke, which is always the thing on cross-country runs, you know, you'd stop in a bush and have a fag. But I just used to be there sort of choking with the smoke because I wanted to have a rest, you know. I hated it. I hate sports.
So you were large and uncoordinated, right?
Large, uncoordinated and spotty, which didn't help. Which is why I started to do impressions, because I thought, well, I'm not going to get girls any other way. I've got to have something to attract them.
So you decided to make people laugh, or you discovered you could make people laugh.
Well, I've got some brilliant friends who I'm still friends with now called Greg, Mac, Tommy, and they used to encourage me all the time. And it was like 20 questions. It was like, you know, do Mick Jagger, do Elvis Presley, do Max Bygraves, do all the cartoons. And they kept doing it all the time. So I got used to doing these command performances wherever I went. And I stopped being scared. It was quite a daunting thing because they were very strict, you know, do Noddy Elder. All right, it's a party! You know, all the time. And it was embarrassing, especially in Sainsbury's and stuff.
It's embarrassing, so, yeah.
So when it came to the, you know, getting up on stage in front of, like, all these people at the Queen Mary Ballroom in Dudley, they had a disco every Sunday and it was really good. And I used to get up and do Elvis impressions just on the dance floor. And one night the DJ said, that looks good, I wonder if I can sing like him as well. And I got up and sang Jailhouse Rock. And I got a big round of applause. And after that I thought, well, I'll have some of this. This sounds good, you know, I like this.
Shall we have a bit of that before we have your second record?
Oh, no, no, Sue, no.
Go on.
No, she keeps doing this to me, listener, because I know there's only one listener. I was in a Chinese restaurant last night, right? And the guy was saying, oh, Lady Henry, brilliant. You know, I won't try and do it in Chinese because it's an insult, but Lady Henry, do Madonna. And I said, I'm not going to do Madonna in the middle of a Chinese restaurant. He said, no, do Trevor McDonald. So I had to do Trevor McDonald to get my pancakes. Thanks a lot, guys. You're worse than them.
All right, I shall let you off and have the second record instead. What is it?
This is brilliant. Now, the reason, I mean, they wouldn't let me have any records, listener. I tried to have everything on, because I'm a DJ, I can do this job. Anyway, this other record, when I was on tour, this album came out by Raikouda called Get Rhythm, and I love Raikouda. He's great. And he sings like a black man, which is really weird. Check this out.
Now, 13 question method is the one to you. Listen to me. 13 question method is the one to you. I'm saying that the 13th question method is the one you gotta use. You wanna have some fun, cause the 13th question method is the one to use. Question number one, you wanna have fun? Question number two, what to do? Let's see. Question number three, wanna go out and eat burger with me? God almighty, well, the 13th question method is the one to use.
Check this out. Sue Lawley was just hooting because I said, check this out. That's DJ parlance for have a listen to this, listener.
We're on Radio 4.
I know. What should I have said? Did the Archbishop of Canterbury say that when he's on it, when he was on here? Check this out, listener. This is Frank Zappa.
That was Raikouda. 13 question method in
great
case anyone
playing
wanted to know. Now, you may have thought, Lenworth Henry,
yes,
that the choice was easy, confronted with whether you wanted to get off into show business and glamorous girls and all the rest of it, or a 3-day release in engineering.
Yeah.
Your parents didn't think it was so easy.
Well, they didn't know. They didn't know that this is what I was doing, you know. When I came back from the audition, my mum said, where have you been? I said, I've been to an audition, and I hadn't told her. I bunked off school and everything, you know, which is one of many times. And then I'd done well. I couldn't believe it. I came home and I was quite excited. And she said, where have you been? It's like 6:30. And I said, I've been in Birmingham. I went to an audition for New Faces. And she said, what, doing what? Because she just didn't know. And I said, well, I'm doing impressions. And she said, well, what did you do? And she made me, before I got a chance to eat, before I got changed or anything, she made me in the hall give this performance of what I'd done that day. So I was in the middle of the hall in our house going, well, there's a wonderful on the money. And good evening, my name is Dave Allen. Thank you very much. You know, and they laughed. They really thought it was funny. And it made me wish that I'd done it before. made me wish that I'd said, you know, oh, I'm thinking of doing this, because maybe I would have got encouragement earlier on.
So off you went, having won New Faces, and then you got a television sitcom.
Michael Grade invited me to go to his office at LWT with a guy called Stuart Allen. We watched an episode of this sitcom called Good Times from America. And what they actually offered me was to play the eldest son in a British version of this sitcom. And it was going to be called The Fosters. And I did 27 episodes of that.
But then the television offers fell away, and you kind of went out.
I had to do some gigs, because I did The Fosters for 2 years, and that was all right. But then I was currently, as well as doing that, I was also doing the Black and White Minstrels in summer season, and I was doing pantomime as well. So I was on a treadmill. I was doing summer season pantomime. And it was hard, but I did it for like 5 or 6 years, and in the end I just said, I can't do this anymore.
Tell me about working with the Black and White Minstrels, because
that was interesting.
Not a pleasant experience, though.
Well, it was, because the only offensive point is that they black up, because they're actually quite nice. They're very nice people, and I learnt a great deal. There were lots of jokes, unkind jokes in the press about, the makeup comes off and all that stuff. And I sort of dealt with that because I was only like 16 or whatever, which in showbiz terms is like being 4. But as I got on, I really did take offence to the blacking up and those stupid Stephen Foster songs, you know, all the doodah dare, Jesus. And, you know, having to give black consciousness awareness meetings to all the minstrels, you know, Lenny, we're not trying to cope with being black, but it's so difficult for us because really it is a facade. And so I would give them, you know, I would raise their consciousness about blackness. And they would, you know, I'd teach them to dance and stuff, teach them to have rhythm, stuff like that. So it was pretty cool.
But it was quite painful too, wasn't it?
I mean, yeah, well, near the end.
Did you not end up in tears sometimes?
I didn't cry or anything like that. I just felt that it was. I just got tired of having these stupid jokes made. A bit when you sweat, you get little white lines running down your face and all that kind of stuff.
Another record, please.
This is King Bob, Bob Marley and the Wailers, and I actually had a holiday in Jamaica recently, and it was absolutely wonderful. And this will remind me of my holiday in Jamaica. Actually, we'll see to be a desert island very well. Bob Marley and the Wailers is This Love.
Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Is it also? Yeah.
Is this Rural
Sound Culture on Radio 4. Just blow! Broadcasting here.
Are you at all practical, Lenny? I mean, are you going to cope on this?
I'm hopeless. You know, I have to change a light bulb and I look at it and just shrug my shoulders. And I do gardening with a flamethrower. If it was me, I'd concrete it all over and everything.
Listen, going back to the career, let's get you out of the Black and White Minstrels. You went back into television, into Tiz Wars.
Yeah, this is the stuff, Anarchy. Sorry, I just had a flashback for a second.
That's all right.
I'm on Radio 4.
Good morning. This is Radio 4. This is 1980, and you started at that stage doing your own characters. Didn't you? I mean, you stopped so many impressions and started creating your own.
I was doing Trevor McDonald and David Bellamy. And I came up with Algernon, Winston, Spencer, Churchill, Gladstone, Disraeli, Palmerston, Pitt the Younger, Pitt the Elder, Heath, Wilson, Thatcher, 10 bloody years, oh my goodness, razzmatazz, okay. And I thought, this is all right, you know. And we had the DCM club. We had the Condensed Milk Sandwich Club. And everybody at Condensed Milk Sandwiches, like Cliff Richard at a Condensed Milk Sandwich. It's like the Pope, you know. And I met Trevor McDonald. Trevor McDonald actually walked on while I was in the middle of doing
some kind of news flash, you know, reports coming in that the children's programmes Crackerjack, Wacky Races and Jack and Ori are being amalgamated into one programme. The new programme will now be called Cracker Wacky Jack and Akinori. And I should do things like that and get covered in, deservedly covered in buckets of water and custard pies.
When did you invent Delbert Wilkins, the Brixton DJ?
Delbert Wilkins first saw the light on OTT as the Brixton Milkman. I was working with this guy called Kelvin, and I had this one car journey with Kelvin, and hello, Kelv, and he said, you know, and you know what I mean, about 4,000 times all the way, you know, and it, and you know what I mean, actually, it suffices for any situation, like you say, look at my car, man, they've clamped it, you know what I mean, oh, it's raining again, you know what I mean, wow, look at this suit, you it actually, it fits any situation, you know. And I just thought, what a good character. And I did it as the Brixton Milkman, who not only delivered milk, but had, like, British Oil shares, you know, seat, airline tickets, wicked suits, televisions, everything. And we did the definitive Delbert after that on Three of a Kind, where he came on in an Anthony Price suit and talked about how the clubs have changed, you know, and how everywhere's a club, they use any venue, you know. I was in this, like, butcher shop the other day, right? And I was buying some pork chops. Suddenly, all these flashing lights come on, right? A Bee Gees record comes on, and the geezer asks me to dance. You know what I mean? I mean, it's ridiculous trying to look cool with a pound of mince in your hands. And that was, like, the first definitive Delbert monologue. That's where the exaggeration started to come in.
But they're all these characters are black stereotypes. And you've been accused a bit, haven't you, in the past?
Early on. And I must contest that, actually, because whatever your race is or whatever you are as a person, wherever you come from, whether you're from a middle-class background, I think you're allowed to make jokes about the community where you come from, you know? It's like Jackie Mason, the Jewish comedian, you know, he does jokes about the differences, the cultural differences between Jews and Gentiles. I think that's allowed. Dave Allen talks about being Irish and, you know, Catholicism and stuff like that.
Another record, please.
This is brilliant. I used to put this on and get incredibly... I used to get sad just because she's got such a brilliant voice, very plaintive voice. And it's still my favourite album, actually. The first album, Ricky Lee Jones, This Is Company. Scoop me out of that bucket, see.
Ricky Lee Jones.
I'm on a desert island. I'm chilly now, so I've got a bit of a rum punch on the go. Somebody's made it for me. I can't do that. And I just had a really nice time, really.
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Hanging out, chilling, cracking gags, the way
Come
you
on
do.
Now. Was there a point, Lenny, at which you decided that you were going to throw out all the old material of the impressions of all these people and actually concentrate entirely on your own characters, your own creations, be original?
It was a gradual thing. It didn't all happen at once. 1981, this alternative comedy thing had been going for a couple of years, and it was starting to come to a head. Alexis Sayre, Rick Mail, Peter Richardson, Nigel Planer, Dawn French, Jennifer Saunders were working at the comic strip where people paid to come and see a show, and it was just... I can't tell you. I suppose to put it into its perspective, it was like punk. It gave comedy a big kick up the bum because for the first time, people in London had an alternative. That's the only reason why the alternative was used. It's a bit of a millstone now. It doesn't really mean anything.
An alternative to what? To the man in the dinner jacket.
Exactly. An alternative to, you know, the guy leaning on the microphone telling jokes about how fat people are.
And his mother-in-law.
And his mother-in-law and you know, darkies, packies, wogs. For the first time, there were people with a political conscience who were doing ideologically sound material, who were being non-sexist and non-racist and pulling on other sources for their material. And I saw these people, and I was blown away, especially by people like Dawn and Jennifer and Alexis Sale, because they were doing material that just didn't depend on any kind of subjugation or oppression. It was just funny. And I thought, well, actually, this is the kind of stuff I want to do this. I can find my niche in this. I know that this is the sort of material that I should be doing. How do I change my image? Because at that time my image was cheeky Lenny, cheeky lanky loony lovable Lenny, you know, and he's a bit of a laugh, you know, he's a black lad, he doesn't mind having a bit of a laugh at himself, you know, and that's who I was at that time.
At the comic strip or the comedy store, you were so blown away, as you said, by Dawn French that you married her.
Oh, well, that was later. I mean, I was blown away by Dawn French, but it was, that took a while to happen. I mean, the reason I was at the comic strip the first time was because we were looking for writers for OTT. And
she turned you down.
Yeah, she said, well, it takes us 6 months to write a sketch, so I think you'd be, I think you'd have a problem with deadlines, Lynn.
But she came, didn't she, to see your act?
I was doing an RAF club in somewhere in Wiltshire, and she saw my act, and I went down very, very well, and I thought, hey, pretty good set, huh? And she just said, how can you do that material? It's awful, you know. And we talked about all the material, and I'd started making noises about wanting to change my act a bit, and I was still in the growth process, and she sort of said, well, you've got to just get rid of all of that stuff about, you know, because I was still doing some material, you know, that was a bit dubious, because it got a laugh. Problem with being a comedian is, if something gets a laugh, you'll cut your leg off before you'll kick it out of the act. So I had to be very brave and lose a lot of material that actually got huge woofers, as they're known in the trade.
Your fifth record, please.
Yes, now this is, you might want to plug your ears for this, but I love it. It's Bootsy Collins, who's this bass player who has created himself as this cartoon. He had many incarnations. He had the Land Shark, he had Casper the Friendly Ghost, and Bootzilla. And he's like this cartoon who plays this bass, and he puts his bass through this weird machine, and it makes all these weird noises. You're not going to like this, Sue. This is I'd Rather Be With You from Stretching Out, Bootsy.
I'd rather be with you. I'd rather be with you until that day will fly away. I just love that smiling face in the early sun. If I can't have you to myself, then life's no fun.
I'd rather be with you.
Sound of Music Colors there, and I'd rather be with you for stretching out.
This is Desert Island Discs Radio 4. Do you ever run out of oomph, Lenny?
Oomph? Sometimes. I get tired sometimes, but when I'm on, I sort of get this adrenaline from somewhere. Got a lot of energy. I think if you say, hey, you know, I've had my own series, you know, I'm making a film, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, you know, why should I work anymore? You know, I think you're just heading downwards.
So you got your own show. In fact, you got your own show back in 84. You also, though, in that year, 84, took two O-levels.
Yes, I was in Blackpool on my own. It was my first summer season top of the bill with David Copperfield at the North Pier Blackpool. And it was something like 20 weeks. And I enjoyed the show, but after a while, your brain just, you get that kind of feeling of, I'm turning into mush, what can I do? And I met this great guy called David Emery, and David Emery said that he could put me through O-levels in 12 weeks. And I said, what? because I left school with more than an impression of Elvis Presley actually, Lawley. I left school with
seven CSEs.
But I'd always felt that it wasn't enough, you know. I always thought, well, it's like toy qualifications, you know. They were always a bit laughed at when, you know, you're doing CSEs. And I sort of wanted O-level, especially English, because I like literature, I read a lot and stuff. So I started to take O-levels, and everybody's laughing at me and everything, but I did it, you know. I'd come in from, from the theatre, and I'd write my essays and deliver them the next morning and stuff. And I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the process and everything.
And what did you get? Come on, you did.
I got two Bs. So I'm like the new English literate blues singer, B.B. Henry. Right, that was my joke after that. But I got two O-levels while I was there, and I also got married in 1984. And it was a real drag because we were getting married in October. I was in Blackpool, so we had to spend a lot of time away from each other, which is a pain in the bum in showbiz. You know, if both of you are in the business, it's worse. And so consequently, we had to spend a lot of time on the phone, and it was a huge period of understanding. And it cemented our relationship in a way, because, you know, if you can stand that, you can stand anything.
But what's it like in your house? I mean, two huge comic personalities under one roof.
It's normal, you know. We try to live as normal life as possible. And if I got up every morning and did impressions of Tommy Cooper and did characters, it'd be very dull after the second day. And I don't think people understand that. I think that because they're taking you at that moment in time when they're talking to you, they think, oh, this is great, it was really funny, you know. But actually, it's just, you know, you're trying to work out how the fridge works and stuff, you know. It's very, very normal. It's a normal life, Sue.
Shall we have some more music?
Yeah, and it's very soppy, listener, so, I mean, if you don't want to listen to this, please. But when we were in Blackpool, we used to ring each other up all the time, and I used to sing this to Dawn on the phone, because we were away from each other, and it's very soppy. Steve Wonder, I just called to say I love you. No New Year's Day! Go on, Steve.
No New Year's Day to chocolate cup of candy hearts to give away. No first of spring, no song to sing. In fact, here's just another ordinary day. No April rain, no flowers.
Records, that's for Dawn. And also, because he sang it on Mandela Day, which is one of a brilliant day for me, and seeing Stevie sing that live was just wonderful. It's great.
I was saying earlier on that you were a moving spirit behind Comic Relief.
One of them. I wasn't the instigator by any means, but I was sort of in at the initial meeting for it when we were planning the first show.
It's an odd business at first glance, though, isn't it? The comedians talking about death and disaster and suffering.
I don't know whether it's an odd business. I think if it stems from caring, if it stems from the heart, then it's all right. And whatever helps, really. You know, my job is as a comedian. And if by comedian I can help people in Ethiopia or Burkina Faso or Mozambique or in Britain, then I'll comed.
To comed, it's a nice verb, yeah.
But when it started, Rowan Atkinson was putting on this show at this Shaftesbury Theatre, I think. And he wanted a lot of comics to do something. And I was invited to appear. And it was great having all the comedians together. There was a really good feeling around. There was no egotism. There was just people saying, "Oh, good set," you know, and people admiring, you know, people from the side of the stage. It was really nice. And we wanted to do it again, and we wanted to sort of see if we could raise more money. I mean, we made a million, and we just thought it was, well, if we could make 3 million next year, it'd be wonderful.
It's incredible power, isn't it?
Well, we just thought it'd be great. So the next year we said, why don't we do a TV show and show lots of brilliant clips and do specially written sketches and stuff like that. And consequently, the next year we had this television Red Nose Day, and people just went balmy, and we raised £16 million. It was beyond our wildest expectations, and it was just a shock. I went into shock, and I was so proud to have been involved with it. Richard Curtis had been to Ethiopia, and he'd been immensely affected by it. It changed his life. And I said to him, well, you know, I'd really like to see what it's like as well. So we arranged for me to go. And I went the first year, and it made me feel very lucky. And it made me think, Christ, we don't know how lucky we are in Britain. You know, we've got, you know, water comes out of a tap, we've got the National Health Service, we've got stuff, we're well looked after, we've got the dole, we've got all kinds of stuff, we can survive. Whereas in Ethiopia and in Burkina Faso, it's a gamble. You might not be able to eat tomorrow. You might not be able to eat the day after. If there's a famine, you might not eat for a month. You might die. And that just affected me. And it affected me the way we waste stuff in this country, the way we throw stuff away. Whereas in Ethiopia and Burkina, they use everything. They use the pots and pans, they use cans, they use tins. It really made me think, you know, in Burkina Faso, we had this big plastic jug. It was like a container, a disposable container for orange squash or something. And we threw it away. And somebody, no! No! Somebody ran to the truck and said, no, please, let us have this. And they used it away, and they're going to use it for something, you know, and it just made me think.
So in that sense, being involved in comic relief and going to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, it's changed your life, you know?
When I first came back, I said, oh, I want to give everything away, after I sobered up, I realised that by being who I am, by doing what I do, it actually helps more than if I just became a field worker or something, you know.
Your seventh record, please.
This is an Elvis Costello song, and it's by Robert Wyatt. This is Shipbuilding.
Is it worth it? A new winter coat and shoes for the white. And a bicycle on the boy's birthday. It's just a rumor that was spread around town by the women and children. Soon we'll be shipbuilding. Well, I ask you, the boy said that they're going to take me to task. It's just a rumor that was spread around town. Somebody said that someone got filled in for saying that people get killed in the result of the shipbuilding.
Robert Wyatt, Shipbuilding. There are, I know you know, an awful lot of cliches started about comedians, that inside they're anxious or hunted or taking revenge on a miserable childhood, or they're laughing because it stops them crying or whatever. I just don't get the impression you fall into any of those categories.
No, it was showing off for my friends, and then when I got into show business, it was, oh God, I better get a modicum of, you know, proficiency into this, otherwise I'll never survive. And then it became a kind of pride in what I was doing. So it's never been a defence mechanism because I'm too big. I've never had to crack gags because I'm like a wimp or anything. I mean I am a wimp because I hate violence of any form or shape or size. But people never bother me anyway because I'm always too big.
But perhaps then the other thing is true that inside the comic there's a serious character waiting to get out.
I think I am serious a lot of the time. I mean, people are surprised when they meet me because they always say, well, go on then, you know.
Like, be funny.
When I'm shopping,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Go on then. Be funny. Go on then.
But is there a serious actor there? I mean, would you like to play, I suppose, Othello, wouldn't you say?
I was talking to my friend David Threlfall about this the other night, and he thinks we should do Othello. And I will do it one day, but not now. I want to do it when I've had a bit more experience acting. and consequently, I mean, we're working on various film scripts at the moment, and I want to do more film acting and TV acting. I've done a couple of films, and I've enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed the experience of developing a character over a longer length of time. And
so we might yet see Lenny Henry's Othello at the National, might we?
I don't know about that. We might be able to put it on in a town hall somewhere. We're going to do Othello now, so shut up. Can we come out to the bar, please? Iago's about to come on. So, one day. I really would like to do it, though.
And so we come to your last record.
My last record is a very serious piece of musical work. It's by a man who has been a great influence on me, proving that you can combine funk with comedy. Here is one of my heroes, George Clinton, with his band Funkadelic and One Nation Under a Groove. Hit it!
Suggest our way out of our constriction. Gonna be freaking up and down the hang up alleyway. With the groove I only got, we shall all be moved. Ready or not, here we come. Getting down on the one which we believe in.
Can I get it on my good foot? Good God. Come on, get down. One time.
We're on the move. Ha, 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 ha,
yeah. Well, there you are. Radio 4, rocking and rolling, reeling and rocking. Getting down on the funky good foot. This is the Archbishop of Canterbury's choice of tunes on his castaway island this week. Go on, Stu.
One Nation Under a Groove by Funkadelic.
Keep broadcasting.
Now you have to choose one of those, Lenny. You know, one that you prefer to all the others that you would have to have.
I think Dawn will kill me if I don't say this. I think I'd have to take the Stevie Wonder tune, I Just Called to Say I Love You, because it's so nice and it would. I can't take my girlie, can I?
No, you can't.
Okay, so I'd have to. It would remind me of my girlie. And it would be very nice, and I'd get all soppy and cry because she wasn't there.
And
so
then,
I'd take that.
Then you have to choose a book, and you've got the complete works of Shakespeare, so you can swat up on the Othello.
Oh, well, that's good.
You've got the Bible.
Uh-huh.
What else would you like to have?
I think I'd have to take Catch 22, because I've read it 4 times, and I still don't know what it's about. So I think it's a book that bears repeated reading. It's such a good hoot and funny, and it's got great characters like Yessarian. I see everything twice! And Major, and Milo Minderbender. It's the great classic. It's a classic book. And every time you start it, you sort of think, what's going on? You know, I do like it.
Right, and a luxury.
A luxury. I'd have to take some graphic novels with me. Now, graphic novels are things like The Watchman by Alan Moore, Cerebus by Dave Sim, and Dark Knight by Frank Miller. Now,
you can't have You're Not Allowed.
Why not? They're comics.
No, you can't.
Why?
Because
it's a luxury. I'm a comics collector, Sue. So what? I can take a book, but I can't take comics. A comic is a luxury. I rest my case, Your Honour. Thank you.
I'm feeling very bullied. Go on,
then. I take all of them.
Finish telling us what it is.
And they're what they are is they are comics with an X, but they're more grown up. They're written with adults in mind. So it's like reading a book, but you've got pictures to look at as well, which I think all books should do anyway. You know, Dickens would be much better if Oliver Twist was a superhero. You know, give me some more or I'll blast you with a photon ray. You know, I mean, that is my kind of Dickens, you know. Bleak House, it'll be bleak when I've used my heat vision on it, pal. The old curiosity shop, take my super breath. Yes.
You got a B for your English literature exam.
Yes, I did. That's why. When I was supposed to be studying my poems, I was reading Frank Miller.
Linworth George Henry from Dudley. Thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your desert island.
It's been an absolute groove, Sue. Thank you.